This is Kathy reading today from the June 29th edition of the Decatur Herald and Review. Front page, home embraces art and wonder. Sculpture-filled Airbnb in Bloomington opens again. By Matuz Janik. Industrial sculpture and colorful murals surround the exterior of Tom Kirk's house on Garland during an open house on Saturday in Bloomington, and it is really something to behold. It is painted with purple and red and bright green mural. There is industrial sculptures on the outside and more on the inside. So it is it's quite a sight. Visitors moved through steel, sculpture, and sound Saturday as Tom Kirk opened the house on Garland once again. This time as an art-filled Bloomington home prepares for its next role as an Airbnb. The transformed home at 1905 Garland Drive opened to the public Saturday with live music by local singer-songwriter and guitarist John Till. For Kirk, the weekend open house marked another step in the evolution of a home that has become part residence, part sculpture, and part public curiosity. After years of adding industrial materials, handmade features, and functional art to the property, he is preparing the space for overnight guests to stay inside what he describes as an art sculpture. "You know, I want them to feel welcome," Kirk said of visitors seeing the house for the first time. "I want them to feel what it took to do this. I want them to be able to appreciate the time that it takes to accomplish a feat like this." The Airbnb plan has forced Kirk to rethink a space that once served as his family home. He said he now thinks of the house in two parts, an entertainment side where the immersive art environment is centered, and a guest side where overnight accommodations are being prepared. "The way that we lived in it, my family and I, is different than the way I've had to present it to the people that are coming here," Kirk said. "We had to make sure that they had bedding and everything, and we just had to make it a little softer than when we lived here." The work also included safety changes. Kirk said he spent nearly a year closing in railings, leveling steps, and making other adjustments before opening the house to overnight guests. "You're inside of an art sculpture," Kirk said. "You need to be careful in here. There's a lot of head bumps." The house on Garland has been years in the making. In January, Kirk hosted another open house in conjunction with the release of The House on Garland, a documentary made by Illinois State University students that explored the home's transformation, Kirk's story and themes of healing, growth, and creativity. At that time, Kirk said 40 new sculptures represented the final additions to The House on Garland, but on Saturday he said finished is a complicated word. "I hear that all the time. Oh, it'll never be done. And I hope that it never is done," Kirk said. "As long as I'm alive and breathing, I would like to come in and make little changes." John Apps, a longtime friend and collaborator, has watched the project develop and helped with handrails, fabrication, and brainstorming. He said many of the house's largest components were already in place before the building around them took shape. "He built all this stuff here and then built the house around it," Apps said. For Apps, the appeal is in the reactions. Visitors notice different things, whether it's a handrail, a huge bucket, a piece of fabrication, or the overall feeling of the place. "That's the best part, is seeing people's reactions," App said. "Everybody sees something that they like." He described the house as controlled madness with a mix of planning and improvisation. "Sometimes you've got this master plan and other times a treehouse," App said. "It doesn't have to be perfect. It doesn't have to be straight. It just has to be there." Jeffrey Bess, an artist who grew up in the neighborhood, met Kirk after driving past the property about 10 years ago and seeing him working in the yard. To Bess, the house on Garland does not feel like a traditional home. "It's an art installation to me," Bess said. "It's like being swallowed by a giant piece of art." Bess says some people have questioned whether a project like Kirk's belongs in a residential neighborhood, while others like the contrast between the house and the surrounding ranch homes. Over time, he said, the project has become more accepted. "The further he goes along, the more it's accepted and the more people really, really enjoy it," Bess said. Don Hart, who previously lived in Bloomington Normal, said he and his wife had seen the house from the outside and watched it develop over time. "Walking through the space Saturday, he was struck by the way Kirk uses materials that might otherwise be discarded." "This is kind of like macro art in a way," Hart said, "taking things that you wouldn't normally consider to be art and forming it in such a way to show texture." Aaron Wolf, one of the ISU student filmmakers behind the documentary, said the house stands out because it is unlike what people usually encounter in daily life. "It's just so out of the ordinary," Wolf said. It's something entirely different from our everyday lives. It just immediately raises questions to anyone driving by or seeing it. It's like an anomaly. Wolf sees the house much like Kirk does, not as a collection of separate objects, but as one larger work that continues to change. I almost consider the little house to be one piece, the same as Tom Wolf said. Every time I walk through there, there's something new. For Kirk, the house is also tied to his own healing. He said he is comfortable speaking with visitors about the role the project played in his life, including his experience with depression and anxiety. I enjoy being like, well, hey, by the way, I've had a really bad depression anxiety, but I was still able to do this, Kirk said. This place healed me 100%. The house on Garling also points toward Kirk's larger ambitions for Bloomington arts community. In January, Kirk discussed his plans for a new build and his work in the warehouse district south of downtown Bloomington, where he has developed 410 Sculpture Park and begun a broader city museum project. As for his place in the local arts community, Kirk said he wants to create space for others. I would just like to put myself as an anchor where I can have other people come in to share, display, create, or just simply feel comfortable, Kirk said. If you want more information, you can contact the gentleman person who wrote this article, Matuz Janik, at 309-820-3234. And a national item on the front page, justices expand gun rights. More firearm cases already on the horizon, by John Krutzel. The U.S. Supreme Court, in a pair of new rulings, has further expanded the Constitution's Second Amendment to right, keep, and bear arms, as the justices consider whether to take up additional gun rights cases for their next term. The court, in a 6-3 ruling on Thursday, powered by its conservative majority, struck down a Hawaii law that required gun owners to get an owner's permission before bringing a handgun onto private property open to the public, such as most businesses. The justice decided unanimously last week to limit the application of a decades-old federal law that bars firearms possession by certain drug users, narrowing a measure that had threatened the gun rights of millions of Americans who use marijuana and own firearms. In a nation deeply divided over how to address persistent firearms violence, including frequent mass shootings, these rulings underscored the court's generally sympathetic approach toward protections enshrined in the Second Amendment. The decisions, experts said, stiffened an already stringent legal test that gun control measures must clear in order to survive scrutiny under the amendment, ratified in 1791, that states, a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Pepperdine University Caruso School of Law professor Jacob Charles said, the two cases confirm the court's extreme skepticism about all manner of gun regulations, especially the new ones. It has created and elaborated a test that makes it exceedingly difficult for legislatures to create gun laws to protect their citizens, Charles said of the court. The rulings were issued as the justices near the end of their current term, which began in October. Gun rights advocates, fresh off their recent legal victories, expressed hope that the court would take up additional Second Amendment cases for its next term, which begins this October. The justices on Thursday gathered for their weekly private conference. Challenges to the legality of state restrictions on assault-style rifles such as AR-15s and large-capacity ammunition magazines were among the appeals up for consideration for a court review. Those cases could be taken up as soon as Monday to be heard in the coming term. Stephen Sambule, an attorney with the pro-Second Amendment group Gun Owners of America, said it's past time for the court to enforce its prior rulings against such measures. It is critical that the Supreme Court take an AR-15 and magazine case and enter the lower court's rebellion against the court's precedent, Sambule said. When the Supreme Court last year turned away appeals in similar lawsuits, three of its conservative justices dissented from the decision to reject the appeals. A fourth conservative justice, Brett Kavanaugh, expressed sympathy toward the argument by the challengers that AR-15s are in common use by law-abiding citizens and therefore are protected by the Second Amendment. Kavanaugh said the court presumably will address the AR-15 issue soon. The court is also considering whether to take up a challenge to a U.S. government ban on federally licensed firearms dealers selling handguns to adults under the age of 21 and similar state law measures, the Bruin test. In both new gun rights rulings, the court applied a legal test that emerged from a landmark 2022 decision authored by conservative Justice Clarence Thomas in a case called New York State Rifle and Pistol Association versus Bruin. Under the so-called Bruin test, gun control measures must be consistent with this nation's historical tradition of firearm regulation, not simply in advance of the important government interest in order to comply with the Second Amendment. Applying that test in the 2024 case of U.S. versus Rahimi, the court, in an 8-1 ruling, upheld a federal law that makes it a crime for people under domestic violence restraining orders to have guns, the only law to survive the Bruin test unscathed at the Supreme Court to date. David Koppel, a Second Amendment expert at the Libertarian Independence Institute think tank, said the dangerousness of domestic abusers is what set the Rahimi decision apart from the two recent rulings. Peaceable people who use marijuana and persons with concealed carry permits are not dangerous, Koppel said, referring to the plaintiffs in the recent gun rights cases. The broad historic traditions invoked by Bruin point towards dangerousness standard as the rule for when some Americans can be disarmed, Koppel added. Hawaii officials had contended that the state's law had struck a proper balance between the right to bear arms and the right of property owners to exclude guns from their property. Liberal Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson, in a written dissent, accused the court's conservatives of having manipulated the Bruin test into a free-for-all that lets the judiciary thwart the will of the legislatures by privileging access to firearms above all else. Pepperdine's Charles dismissed the notion advanced by some of the court's conservatives that the right to keep and bear arms is being treated like a second-class right. The court's decision has elevated the Second Amendment right far above the first-class right, Charles said. This headline on page A2, Police Seek Help After Two Men Shot and Wounded in Decatur, by Tony Reed. Police are seeking help and information from the public as they investigate two incidents of gun violence on Decatur streets within a few days of each other that left two men with gunshot wounds, one of them hit three times. That incident happened around 4:30 p.m. Thursday as the 35-year-old victim was driving in the area of West Sunset and Oakland Avenues and told police his car was hit by gunfire. The victim drove himself to the hospital, said Sergeant Nicholas Errett with the Decatur Police Department. He had gunshot wounds to his left hand, one in his left hip, and a third one in the rear of his upper left thigh. The wounds were non-life-threatening. Errett said investigating officers were unable to locate a crime scene, but said the victim described the gunfire as coming from another vehicle. The sergeant said officers were still working to piece together the circumstances surrounding how the shooting went down, and he said the victim had been somewhat cooperative in the investigation. The second shooting occurred just after 9 a.m. Saturday, when Errett said patrol officers responded to the 1300 block of West Wood Street after reports of gunfire. He said they found a 29-year-old man who lives in that area inside his home with a gunshot wound in the foot. Errett said the victim had offered some background information about how the shooting happened, but police were working to learn more. Anyone with information on either of these shootings can reach detectives at 217-424 2734 or call Crime Stoppers at 217-423-8477. This next article says that 84 Paul Simon's shows still resonate, by Dr. Barton Goldsmith. There was a noticeable divide in the audience at intermission. I didn't pay $300 to hear this one, concertgoer said after Paul Simon performed Seven Psalms, his 2023 album. I understood exactly what he meant. I just disagreed. If you came looking for a nostalgia show, the first half probably felt like homework. But if you came willing to follow an 84-year-old artist wherever his mind has taken him, it was something else entirely. Before the concert, I had listened to Seven Psalms several times and read through the lyrics. I still don't know whether Simon arrives at faith or skepticism. My guess, he isn't trying to arrive anywhere. He's still searching, and there's something profoundly honest about a man in his ninth decade standing before thousands of people and admitting that life's biggest questions remain unanswered. One brief phrase, the sacred harp, stayed with me long after the lights came up. Not because it explained anything, but because it didn't. Then came the songs that we have lived with for decades. Some were the expected favorites, others were deep album cuts that longtime fans greeted like old friends. The appearance of one of the original Graceland musicians drew a deserved ovation and reminded everyone that these songs have histories of their own. Paul Simon is 84. That fact matters, but not the way people think. His voice isn't what it was in 1975, nor should it be. It has become the voice of someone who lived the questions he spent a lifetime writing about. Listening to him now, I wasn't hearing diminished talent. I was hearing accumulated experience. Voices deepen with age, so do the songs if you let them. Simon spoke candidly about his neuropathy and spent much of the evening holding the guitar, playing only the occasional riff. When he finally settled in and gently played at the end, the moment felt almost ceremonial. As a guitarist myself, I noticed something that many people probably missed. The intricate parts Simon once played alone are now divided between two outstanding musicians. That isn't a criticism of age, it's a reminder of how extraordinarily difficult his playing always was. I spent years trying to figure out his chord voicings and fingerstyle patterns, and like so many players of my generation, I learned what sounded effortless was anything but. One song, though, landed differently than I had ever heard it before. When Simon sang the Boxer, I no longer heard the story of a fictional fighter. I heard the story of a man standing in front of us. The reverence to every glove that cut him suddenly felt less like poetry and more like autobiography. Every artist who survives 6 decades accumulates scars, critical failures, commercial disappointments, personal losses, physical limitations, and the quiet realization that time eventually wins every contest. Yet there he stood, not trying to recapture his youth or prove anything to anyone, but simply doing what he has always done, telling the truth through song. The performance was moving, not because it was flawless, but because it was honest. As I looked around the Hollywood Bowl in Los Angeles, another thought occurred to me. These songs had long since outgrown their creator. They had become part of the emotional vocabulary of several generations. The moment I'll remember happened in the audience. Toward the end of the evening, I stopped singing. I closed my eyes and listened. The bowl became a choir. Thousands of people knew every word, every harmony, every pause. They belonged to all of us who had carried them through first loves, road trips, marriages, heartbreaks, losses, and quiet Sunday mornings. As a young musician, I spent countless hours trying to play like Paul Simon. I never got there, but the pursuit made me a better player. More importantly, his songwriting taught me that intelligence and melody could live comfortably together, that simplicity could hide astonishing complexity, and that the questions are often more enduring than the answers. Whether this is his final major tour really doesn't matter. The standing ovations at the Hollywood Bowl felt less like an applause for a concert than gratitude for a lifetime of work. His hands may no longer play every intricate passage they once did, but somewhere along the way, the songs have stopped belonging to Paul Simon. They became ours. And for a few beautiful moments, with my eyes closed, the finest instrument on the stage wasn't the guitar or the extraordinary band. It was 12,000 people singing Thank You. And then it lists all places where he's going to be playing. None around here, though. Spotlight in the business section. Luxury property buyers flock to Spain seeking haven from war and turmoil by Corinna Pons and Carol Badal Riders. Madrid. Wealthy Polish, American, and Persian Gulf-based property buyers are pouring into Spain's capital, Madrid, and Costa del Sol, seeking luxury refuge from the wars in Ukraine and Middle East, as well as political turmoil in the United States. Spain, particularly its Mediterranean coast, was long a magnet for sun-seeking Britons and Germans. In recent years, a broader mix of investors looking to diversify their assets and hedge against instability moved in. A half dozen real estate agents, European housing market analysts, and a property lawyer told Reuters. Official government data confirmed the trend. Whether it's Ukrainians or Poles settling on the Costa del Sol or Americans coming to Spain, the common factor is the geopolitical situation, said Rebecca Caballero, head of Realtor Gilmar's international department. According to last year's property register data, more than 39% of all home sales in the major tourist provinces, including Malaga on the Costa del Sol, Alicante on the Costa Blanca, and the Balearic Islands, involved foreign buyers. That helps send prices surging in a country where housing is a major political issue and the central bank called for coordinated policy efforts to boost housing supply with an estimated shortage of 750,000 homes. Ukraine war triples the Polish property demand. Buyers from Poland, among Europe's fastest-growing economies, invested in Spanish coastal property since 2020, but their purchases tripled since the COVID-19 pandemic and accounted for 4% of all foreign purchases last year, up from 1.6% in 2019. The strongest wave of investment came after the outbreak of the war in Ukraine, with a frenzy of purchases made over the phone, said Agnieszka Marciniak-Kozistra, founder of a Marbella-based real estate agency. Marlena Bartkowiak is part of that surge. The 46-year-old, who owns a transport company in Poland, purchased an apartment in Bendelmandina on Andalusia's Costa del Sol as a backup plan when the war broke out. Spain came to mind as it was somehow the least involved in all sorts of political maneuvering on the European stage, said Bartkowiak, who primarily lives in Poland. Niner Homes, one of Spain's largest property developers, sold 70% of its premium 102-home Santa Clara complex completed in Marbella last year to Polish clients. Polish buyers dominate a 64-floor skyscraper under construction in Benidorm, another coastal hotspot. Alternative to Dubai. Spain right now is a diversification play on security grounds, said Paloma Perez Bravo, CEO of real estate firm Dils Lucas Fox. In the same way the conflict on Poland's eastern border drove Polish purchases, real estate agents saw an influx of demand from investors based in the Persian Gulf after the outbreak of the Iran war. Three real estate firms told Reuters they are negotiating luxury property deals on the Costa del Sol with buyers from Dubai as the conflict deals a blow to the Emirates' image as a peaceful haven for the rich. At least two deals already were completed. Marciniak Kozrzua recently sold a property to a Polish client living in Dubai who sought a safer alternative base for their family. While Dubai wooed foreigners with zero property tax, realty lawyer Maria Ruiz Lopez said regional wealth, tax exemptions, or allowances are a draw for Madrid and the Costa del Sol, making them more attractive to rich buyers than other parts of Spain. We believe there will be an opportunity to attract those seeking an alternative to Dubai, partly because conflicts make Spain appear as a calmer option, said Mario Lapidra Vivianco, deputy CEO at Niner, which already closed a deal with a buyer from Dubai. Higher prices feed the investment trend. It's not just violent conflict, but also the political and social pressure, said Gilmore's Caballero, pointing to the surge in Americans, many of them Hispanic, who invested in Spain since President Donald Trump's return to office last year. Many do it as an investment, and others see it as a plan B because they don't know what's going to happen in the United States, she said. From 2024 to 25, Gilmore saw U.S. investment surge from 0.5% to 6.2% of its property transactions, and Americans overtake Britons as the leading foreign buyers on the Costa del Sol. Across Spain, Americans accounted for 2% of property purchases by foreigners and paid the third highest average price after Swedes and Germans, according to data from the General Council of Notaries. The broadening pool of foreign buyers pushed up home values. Real estate agents dealing in properties priced between $1.13 million and $22.68 million say the rising values make buying in Spain an attractive investment, reinforcing the trend and setting the market apart. The warm climate and stable economy also attract buyers. Jack Harris, a London-based partner in Knight Frank's international residential team, said that luxury home prices in Spain rose by as much as 9.5% year-on-year, faster than in other European markets like France and Italy. Spain has been something of an outlier in terms of performance across Europe over the last 12 months, he said. Trump to get housing bill. Johnson pressures Senate leader to pass voter ID measure by Katherine Jackson. U.S. House Speaker Mike Johnson said Sunday he would send a bipartisan housing affordability bill to President Donald Trump on Monday, days after the Republican president refused to sign the bill until a divisive voting rights measure was passed. It's passed by both chambers. I'm sending it to him on Monday, and it will become law, Johnson said, a Republican from Louisiana. Sunday morning futures program. Trump abruptly canceled a signing ceremony for the housing legislation Wednesday in an effort to pressure Republicans into passing a controversial voter ID bill known as the Save America Act. The voting act would require a photo ID to vote in federal elections and proof of U.S. citizenship to register, while compelling states to turn over their voter registration rolls to the federal government. The bill, which faces vehement opposition from Democrats, passed the House of Representatives in February, but has since languished in the Senate. Johnson met with Trump on Thursday to discuss a legislative pass forward for the Voting Act and rescheduling the housing bill signing. Trump supporters want to include the Save America Act in a special budget reconciliation bill that could pass the Senate with 51 Republican votes and overrule the parliamentarian, the official charged with upholding the chamber rules, if the voter ID measure is ruled ineligible as it was earlier this year. Democrats say the voter ID law is designed to make it more difficult to vote for thousands of Americans, particularly those in heavily Democratic districts. Because the housing bill was passed by both houses of Congress, it could become law whether Trump signs it or not. Under the Constitution, after receiving the bill, the president has 10 days to sign or veto, and if he declines to do either, it would become law without his signature. Johnson said he met with Senator Majority Leader John Thune of South Dakota and implored him to pass the voter ID measure. He's got a big challenge on his hands, of course, and I've encouraged him to do everything possible within his power to move it. I believe he will, Johnson told Fox. We'll send them over a provision that fits. Scientists, heat wave is the worst ever. Soaring temperatures affect healthcare, transportation, and utilities by McKinney Bryce, Francesca Landini, and David Graham. Temperatures hit 104 degrees Sunday in parts of Europe as storms moved into other areas, with France reporting 1,000 excess deaths during the record-breaking heat wave. The French Public Health Agency said most of the heat-related fatalities involved older people and warned the number was expected to rise as more details become available about deaths in residential care and private homes. Scientists said the heat wave, which began June 20th, was the worst recorded in Europe, and the blistering conditions disrupted power generation, damaged infrastructure, and overwhelmed healthcare systems. Right now, 150 million people are living under extreme heat. Hundreds have died. Schools are shut. Grids are buckling. World Health Organization Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus said on social media. Driven by climate change and global warming, the phenomenon of the once-in-a-generation heat wave is now occurring nearly annually. We were warned, he wrote, adding that Europe's homes, workplaces, and schools were ill-equipped for extreme heat. The heat wave would have been virtually impossible without human-caused climate change, which has made this week's soaring nighttime temperatures 100 times more likely than they would have been just two decades ago, according to scientists. Temperatures topped records in Austria, the Czech Republic, Germany, and Poland, while storms broke out in parts of France, causing further disruption to travel and power supplies. In Germany, train services were reduced on a major rail line in the western state of North Rhine-Westphalia, and trams were suspended in the eastern city of Leipzig. Many people hunkered down at home, reluctant to go outside until the sun went down, local media reported. In Rome, Pope Leo thanked worshippers for attending Sunday's prayer in St. Peter's Square despite the sweltering conditions. The extreme heat also affected Europe's rivers, depleting and warming their waters, and causing problems for electricity generation and agriculture. Hungary's Pax nuclear power plant reduced output again Sunday due to the high temps of the Danube River that it uses as a coolant, the government said. In Italy, the flow of the Po dwindled, allowing seawater to travel as far as 11 miles inland, and raising fears for agriculture and protected wetlands in the river delta. Dozens of people seeking relief from the heat were reported to have drowned. In Italy, rescuers were searching for the husband of Cabinet Minister Eugenio Rossella, who went missing Saturday while swimming in Lake Vico, 44 miles from the Roman capital. And that's all for part one. This is Kathy Reed reading to you. I'll be right back with part two.